My name is Abir Alagawi. I am 33 years old. Today's date is March 10th, 2020, and we're in Las Cruces, New Mexico. I am interviewing my husband, Marshawn McDermott Rowe.
I'm Marshawn McDermott Rowe. I'm 32. Today's date is March 10th, 2020. We're in Las Cruces, New Mexico. I'm being interviewed by my wife, Abir Alagawi.
Okay. So, Marshawn, I'd like you to tell me a little bit about where you grew up and what that was like.
Well, I was born in New York City, and I grew up for the most part on Roosevelt Island. So, this was back when it was pretty much like mostly Section 8 housing and diplomats. Like, my neighbor growing up was Kofi Annan, who was the one-time Secretary General of the United Nations during the invasion of Iraq. So, and then I was actually taught German as a child by the wife of the German ambassador to the UN. So it was a weird combination, like Section 8 and diplomats.
That must have been a really cool experience.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily use the word cool to describe it. The place was kind of a crapple, to be honest. And I'm trying to be polite in that phrasing. But Roosevelt Island's changed a lot over the years. But in those days, it was awful. I mean, it was just, you know.
So we're here today because you are a veteran and currently serving the U.S. Army Reserves and Peace Corps. And I'm just wondering, what made you choose to go into the military?
Well, being a soldier is all I've ever wanted to do. Like from the time I was four, I guess I'd wanted to be a mountain climber before that. And then just when I was four, I decided I wanted to be a soldier. And that was it. That was all I ever wanted to be. The very first word I learned to spell when I was a kid was Army. All my books were Army. You know, it's like that was all I ever wanted to do. And a lot of it was because I come from a military family. You know, both my grandfathers, when World War II broke out, had volunteered for service. My mother's father, Nathan Marchand, he was too short. He was only 5 foot tall. So he was rejected based on his height. And by the fact that he was also essential to the War Department because he also was he was one of the guys who helped invent radar. Mm-hmm. So and then my grandpa, William Thomas, he was actually commissioned into the Navy. They gave him his commission, but he was the chief electrical engineer for GE. So they ended up actually – the War Department said, nope, and grabbed him and wouldn't let him go to war. And instead, his brother – Art Thomas, who I was always very close to growing up, he was drafted. And he was first wave at Leyte and first wave at Okinawa with the 93rd Infantry Division. So I always grew up just surrounded by his stories. And then I had my great-great uncle Kenneth, who had volunteered for the U.S. Cavalry. He fought Pancho Villa in Mexico. He lied about his age to join the cavalry. Fought Pancho Villa in Mexico, volunteered for service in World War I, went to volunteer for service in World War II. And when they told him they wouldn't make him an officer, he was like, ah, screw this. And his brother Leslie, who was too young for World War I, though in his 40s at this point, decided, well, war sounds like a lot of fun, volunteered for service, joined the 3rd Infantry Division, their fight up through Italy, and apparently said it was the best time of his life. And then I also had family who fought in the Civil War. My great-great-grandfather, Abraham Heidenheim, he was a cavalry officer in the Civil War. So I grew up surrounded in this military culture, you know. The only person who really didn't want me to go into the armed forces was my dad. But, it was in my blood. I mean, there's no other way to describe it.
So how did you explain to your parents that you had enlisted?
I lied to them. I went to the recruiting station. I was a volunteer firefighter at the time. And I said, oh, I need my birth certificate, my GED, and all this stuff for, you know, a records update with the fire department. And my dad's malicious, but he's also a bit of a dope. And so he gave it all to me. And then I went down to the recruiter station. And I was like, I want to join the infantry. And they said, well, we don't have infantry in the reserve. Because the caveat my mother had told me was that if I were to go into the army, because she knew I was stubborn and was going to do it anyway, that I go into the reserve first. Because this way, if I decide I love it, I can switch over to active duty, or I could just stay in the reserve, you know. But she was like, that's my caveat for my support. My father was still like, no way in hell. So I went down to the recruiter station. I filled out all the paperwork. I took the ASVAB. I said, I wanted to go infantry. They said, we don't have infantry in the reserve. So I said, well, what's the closest thing you got? And they go, military police. And they showed me videos of guys rolling around Strikers, blowing stuff up. And I was like, that's what I want to do. You know, I still have yet to ever do that 13 years later. But
so tell me, what's the funniest thing that ever happened to you at boot camp?
It was when Private Filon decided it would be a good idea to put medicated foot powder on his balls. That was literally the funniest thing I have ever, because it was like the day before graduation. And mind you, basic training for me was very different than it is today. I mean, they could still scream at us, call us names. We had a couple privates get punched when I was there. I mean, I swear to God, it was Alpha Company 796 on Fort Leonard Wood. And we were actually the last cycle of that battalion. They disappeared after that. But Alpha Company 796. And this was 2008. This was summer of 2008. And Filon decides that, you know, we've been told from the beginning, don't put medicated foot powder on anything other than your feet. And he decides, I'm going to put it on my nuts. And mind you, I'm on the top bunk of my bunk. He's on the top bunk of the bunk next to me. And I'm going to do this. And I said, Filon, just shut up. And he goes, no, I'm going to do this. All right, whatever. So I roll over and I just hear him pull down his drawers, a slapping sound. He pulls them up and then he goes, I did it. And about like 5.5 seconds later, I hear, oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, why didn't they tell me it was going to hurt this much? I got to go to the latrine. So he jumps off the bunk and he goes, goes to run for the bathroom. And then our fire guard, who are doing their evening count, go, no, Filon, you can't go anywhere. We have to count you. He goes, okay. He grabs onto my bunk and just starts turning all red and huffing and puffing. And he's like, I can't. And I felt bad for my battle buddy who was sitting on the bottom bunk because look at this sweaty idiot over him, you know, turning all kinds of red. He's like, I can't take it. File into the latrine. He runs off to the bathroom. And, you know, of course, my first thought, because I was the only EMT in the class, was, oh, God, he needs to use cold water because it's chemicals, cold water. He runs in there, and, of course, the first thing he does is use copious amounts of hot water. And then he says the funniest thing I've ever heard a human being say. As he's splashing water, and he slams his drawers shut, and he kind of curls up a little bit, and he goes, it's not working. It's going to fall off. Dear God, it's going to fall off. I died. I just collapsed. I was peeing myself on the floor. It was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. Like, and we just turned into a massive heap of, like, four GIs just piled up on the floor, you know, laughing. And then he goes, I got an idea, runs in the shower, drops his drawers, and turns on the hot water again. He goes, nothing helps. And I forget who it was, but one of the dudes comes running in, and he's like, cold water, you dumbass, and turns on the cold water. That was, yeah, and then at the end of all that, he climbs up onto the top bunk of, onto his bunk, mm-hmm. as we're all kind of in tears, and I'm wiping the tears away from my eyes, and we, some were like, finally, put your fucking shorts on. We have female drill sergeants that come through, and he goes, no, guys, I gotta let it air.
So I take it that's one of your fondest memories.
Oh, yeah, especially since it didn't happen to me. You know, it was great.
So, Marshawn, you've been in the military for 13 years, and you've been deployed twice. Can you tell me a little bit about your first deployment?
So my first deployment was to Afghanistan in 2003 with the 344th Military Police Company. It was the first deployment of that company as a company, like deploying as a company-sized element since the Gulf War. And oddly enough, actually, one of my NCOs, the guy who eventually became my Guard Force commander, Staff Sergeant Michelisi, he actually had deployed with the 344th into the Gulf. And so this was his second. He had deployed a couple times between them, but not with the 344th. This was his second combat tour with the 344th as a cohesive unit. So we were stationed at Camp Sabalu Harrison, which was not far from Bagram Airfield. You had Bagram Airfield, FOD, Warrior, and then us in Parwan Province. And our job was to train, advise, and assist the Afghan National Army in running the Afghan National Detention Facility in Parwan, which was a complete and utter exercise in futility. I don't know what happened to human civilization as it kind of passed through Afghanistan, but I got the impression with the Afghans that the Renaissance was just something that happened to other people. You know, it's it's like bizarre. Like, but our job, we worked hand in hand with them and directly with the detainees. So I was responsible. I was a sergeant in the guard for a modular detainee housing unit. And I was responsible for 17 Afghan soldiers and ballpark about 180 detainees in six communal cells of about 33 apiece, ballpark.
So what did you so what did those people have to do to end up there?
They had to be captured by Afghan National Army. Some of them were captured by U.S. Army. We had a few high-value detainees. We had a guy called the Russian. Don't know a whole lot about him. He was in U.S. custody because part of the facility, a few housing units were still controlled by U.S. forces. It was the last U.S.-run prison in Afghanistan. And they were those held the high value. So we had like the Russian, who was apparently ex-Russian special forces. Don't know a lot about him, but I do know that he threw a table through an interrogation window once. So, I mean, he was a big dude. And then we had Osama bin Laden's accountant was held there as well. But in my section, it was all people who had been captured by the Afghan National Army, some of whom were suicide bombers. We had one dude I had a conversation with who said, you know, I was like, so what are you doing here? He goes, ah, I walk up to checkpoint, click, and nothing happened. So he had gone in with a suicide vest, and it just didn't work. And that's how he ended up captured. And then some of them I talked to were old guys who had been fighting. Like one of them said, I'd asked him, you know, well, you know, what brought you, why are you here? Why were you fighting? And he goes, well, you know, it's I joined the Mujahideen to fight the Soviets when I was 14 and just never stopped. It's just that was the whole way of life. So to say war is a way of life over there is literally no exaggeration. And then, you know, because there's always a lot of myth that surrounds the people of Afghanistan, but I actually got to interact directly with them. And like in this dude's case, that was absolutely the case. And then a total and utter ignorance of the outside world. They had literally no idea where the United States was relative to Afghanistan. They had no idea who the people of the United States were. Like they said, they genuinely believed that we were the infidel coming to invade Afghanistan and wipe out Islam. You know, and because one of them asked me, he goes, so why are you here? And I said, well, you know, terrorists that were in Afghanistan attacked America. And he goes, Afghanistan couldn't attack America. We were minding our own business, and then you showed up and bombed us. And for a lot of them, that's very, very true. We just, one day, it was the Russians were there bombing them, then the Russians left. Then the Mujahideen and the Taliban were duking it out with each other. Then the next day, we showed up. And so for a lot of the members of the Taliban, for a lot of these rural people, that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, but war and brutality to each other is just the norm. I mean, again, we kind of live in a society where we have this sort of almost sort of, you know, one could say this bourgeois liberal notion that, you know, well, everybody is fundamentally, you know, peaceful and wants to get along together. It's just bad circumstances. Well, in a place like Afghanistan, brutality is the norm. Ethnic cleansing is the norm. I had a prisoner that was brought in who was Ismaili, which is a sect of the Shia. And for some reason, he'd been captured because he was involved in anti-government operations. And they put him in a cell with a whole bunch of Sunnis. And the Sunnis were trying to kill him. And it was only because of my rapport with the guard force commander that they didn't kill him, you know. And but that went not just for the Taliban, but for the Afghan National Army. Those guys hated each other's guts if they were from different ethnic groups. You know, we had one dude who was a sergeant of the guard who was Pashai, which is an ethnic minority, and all the Tajiks and Uzbeks hated him. Like, they treated him like garbage. And you got the impression the only thing keeping them from killing him was the fact that we were there, mm-hmm. you know. And similarly, if you had a group of Pashtuns and one Tajik, or a group of – we had an interpreter who was Hazara, who are descendants of Mongols, and they were Shia. And, you know, this interpreter, we had to protect him all the time because if left alone with the Afghan army, they would kill him. So, you know, brutality to each other. And so just the reason why I'm explaining this is because this is just to give you the backdrop of our job was to train these people into one cohesive national army. They couldn't even identify as one national group. And we're trying to create an army out of this. So that was kind of this monumentally impossible task we were given.
Wow. I remember, Marchand, while you were out there, we Skyped one time, one of the few times, because internet out there was almost non-existent.
Yeah, Sniper Hill sucks for generations. I might be listening to this, you know, years from now. I would just want to say Sniper Hill sucks, but go ahead.
So, yeah, we were, I remember one time we were Skyping, and all of a sudden I heard a big boom, and then you had to leave. And that was the Afghans or the Taliban attacking your location. Was that really common? How did you deal with that?
Oh, yeah, we got hit all the time because, again, you know, the problem is the war was fought by politicians. You know, we lost in Afghanistan not because of the fighting spirit of American soldiers, because, like, you know, the one true bastion of real old Americanism, you know, and I can say this as somebody who grew up surrounded by World War I vets. I grew up surrounded by World War II vets. You know, as Patton said, Americans love to fight. They love the sting of battle. Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. And that ethos is still true in the American military. It is not true of our politicians. And our soldiers, in a lot of ways, I believe, were stabbed in the back by our politicians because we fought and bled to control those mountains. And then because President Obama at the time had decided that we were going to hand security over to the Afghan army, our patrols left. And the Afghan army was utterly incapable. As I said, they were killing each other as much as they were killing the enemy. But the president was going to end the war. And as far as the average American was concerned, I mean, we'd been at war for so long by that point, 2013. Most people didn't care anymore. Iraq was the main headline, and by that point, Iraq had ended. So I had people when I came home who told me, well, you were in Afghanistan, but the war's over. Obama ended the war. No, the guy didn't end the war, and I'm trying to be polite, but the guy didn't end the war. In fact, actually, what ended up happening was we gave security back to the Afghan National Army, and the Taliban took the mountains. And I remember talking to I had a couple good Afghan soldiers there that I trusted implicitly. One was Ismail Khan, who I've actually just gotten in touch with recently, and I couldn't be happier to find out he's alive. And Ramesh, both of whom were brilliant. They both taught themselves fluent English. So I could talk to them on a level I couldn't talk to other Afghans. I didn't need an interpreter. And one of them, I remember talking to Ramesh, and I said, you know, just out of idle curiosity, the Taliban control those mountains. They're firing rockets in on us on a regular basis. In fact, the day before I landed, on my fob, four guys were killed by a rocket. And so, you know, I'm like, and he looks at me and he goes, they called me Abdullah. You know, part of it was because my last name, McDermott Rowe, is way too hard to say. So they called me Abdullah, which I appreciated. But the thing that really blew me away was he said, very frankly, you have MRAPs. We have pickup trucks. MRAPs are mine-resistant armored personnel vehicles. You have MRAPs. You have MACVs. We have pickup trucks and Humvees. We're not stupid. We're not going up into those mountains to have those guys shoot at us, you know, because we hadn't created a professional army. What we did basically when we went into Afghanistan was we took a bunch of warlords, people like Hamid Karzai was a warlord, people like the Northern Alliance, and we threw money at them and we said, make an army. And that's basically what you saw. General, what the hell was his name? The general that ran our prison, because he was nominally the landowner. It'll come back to me. But the Afghan general that ran our prison, he was basically a warlord. And so you were dealing with warlord armies. These guys were not professional soldiers. They were not being paid as professional soldiers. They were not being trained as professional soldiers. They had a zero level of competence, and most of the officers couldn't read and write. If that was the norm, to encounter a lieutenant or a captain or a major who could not read or write. So, you know, these guys were like, we're not dumb. We're not going up with no resources to get killed by the Taliban. So they controlled the mountains. So they fired rockets into us all the time, especially in the summer. In the winter, we got a little infrequent. But one time, I remember, they hit us. The BDOC told me it was about 21 times when I was one after the other, after the other, after the other. And then somebody ended up calling for air support because we, as far as I know, weren't allowed air support. But somebody said, these guys are getting lit up. Somebody's going to get killed. And we didn't have the CRAM that they had on Bagram, which is basically this automatic machine gun turret that's basically a giant Gatling gun that when the rocket flies in, it intercepts and blows it up. We didn't have that because we weren't important enough. So, you know, these things were landing all over the place, and somebody authorized two A-10s to come in, and they smoked these dudes. It's the most amazing scenario because you have these explosions going off around you. You know, your kids screaming. You know, those of us who've been in the country a little while just sort of sat there and just sort of jolted because we'd been there for a couple months by that point, you know. And then you heard the A-10s whip around, the afterburners kick in, and then you hear the sound of that Gatling gun go, boom, because they have to kick in the afterburners again. Otherwise, the gun will stall out the engine and the plane will crash. It's basically a plane built around a gun. It is the most beautiful sound I've ever heard. Boom. Boom. And then one of them dropped a gravity bomb. I don't know what kind, but you heard kaboom. I mean, they blew the ever-living daylights out of these guys. Well, the next day, I'm in for my morning guard mount briefing, and it turned out that what S2, military intelligence, had found on these guys afterwards was Pakistani ISI IDs. These guys were not only trained by the ISI, they were members of the ISI. And here's, you know, President Obama saying the Afghan army can stand up on its own and are good friends in Pakistan. And we were fighting the Pakistanis. We were fighting the Taliban and we were fighting the Pakistanis. And it was incredibly frustrating because that's why I say the U.S. military was stabbed in the back by our politicians because our politicians did not have the will to fight the war to win it, which would have required 100,000 boots on the ground, and it would have required us putting our boot on the financial neck of the Pakistani government. Because let's face it, at the end of the day, we give them billions a year. We threaten to cut off that funding. It means a lot, especially because they're scared to death of India.
Yeah.
But we weren't willing to put the squeeze to the Pakistanis. We weren't willing to actually fight the war to win it. So the Taliban controlled the country. And I think as of this recording, the last thing I read was the Taliban controlled by 80% of the country. And it was certainly, at least around my FOB, they controlled everything outside that wire.
So, Marchand, we don't have much time, but I just want to ask you, like, do you have any fond memories of that time? Like, how did you guys, you know, kind of lighten up the mood considering you're being shot at constantly?
So Sergeant McAleese, he had joined the Army, or Staff Sergeant McAleese, I should say, give him full credit. He had joined the Army in 1979. This was his last deployment. I mean, dude was old as dirt. But we decided, so the officers had a cigar bar that they had the engineers make for them, and it was officers only and contractors only. Enlisted could only come based on invitation, you know. Really irritating, you know.
And you are enlisted.
I am enlisted. I was a sergeant at the time. I am currently a staff sergeant now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I got promoted last weekend. But anyway, so I'm still an MP, surprisingly. But anyway, so McAleese decided, he's like, you know what? Screw these officers. They think they're so much better than us. Well, guess what? We're going to create a cigar bar for the enlisted. So we took a bunker that was outside because they had these little dingy little bunkers. And we took a bunker that was right outside his little chew because we lived in these mm-hmm. little storage, two-man storage containers. You know, actually, I'm half the size of this interview, this broadcasting room. But anyway, it's so what McAleese did was he basically took this bunker and we hung lights in it and he spray painted the words Club Fez on the inside because he had a fez that he wore and he was the grand poobah of Club Fez. I was the master at arms, apparently, whatever the hell that means. And we would all bring cigars and we'd sit there and smoke. And that's how we spent Christmas Eve and Christmas, you know, into the early Christmas morning was we sat there smoking cigars and then the occasional rocket would get fired at us and we just played Christmas music on, you know, somebody's mm-hmm. iPod. And that's, you know, that was probably my fondest memory was just sitting there. And it was all first names. Didn't matter whether you were a sergeant or a private. Inside Club Fez, it was all first names.
Aww.
So that's probably, you know, that's how we lighten the mood. And then one of my fondest memories was the Brits because they were just, they were goofy. Like we took fire once, and I remember hearing a group of Brits. I was standing outside with them, and they're like, "Oh, should we go to the bunker? Oh, yes, let's go to the bunker. I haven't been to the bunker yet. Oh, this is fun. Oh my God, these bunkers are so small. Are they designed for like American midgets or something? Oh, I sat in a puddle. Oh, the pong in here is terrible. Could you imagine dying inside this thing?" So I will say, I will forever love the British Army. But
Marchand, as we wrap up, I just want. We have a little boy. His name is Hamza William Angel, and he is 4 years old. What are your hopes and dreams for him for the future? I mean, he's obviously obsessed with everything military. What do you hope for him?
Well, you know, I hope that I can enable him if he does want to be a soldier. I'm obviously not going to make him. But if he does decide he wants to be a soldier, I want to give him all the opportunities I was never given because I was homeschooled, which sucked, but that was miserable. But I was really stifled in a lot of ways from pursuing a military career. That's why I ended up enlisted, you know, as opposed to going to a military academy because, my father didn't want me to. But if Hamza wants to go into the military, if this is something he wants to do, I want to make sure that he can go to a good academy, that he can get the proper training. And then, of course, because I'm Jewish, he will have the option of either going into the U.S. Army or into the IDF. Which I'm always a little, with the way things are going nowadays, I'm always a little partial to him going into the IDF because one thing I will say is you know, the Israelis never abandon their troops. The Israeli government always backs their military. So, you know, but at the end of the day, as long as he can have the opportunities I didn't, I will be happy for him.
Thank you very much, Marchand, for opening up and talking about your military experiences with me. I feel very privileged to be part of this.
Yeah, thank you. And I would like the chance to mention one person that I was deployed with, which was, aside from Staff Sergeant Michelisi, which was Maddie Nelson, who was one of my soldiers that was assigned to me. And I feel like this is, since we just got a minute, a very important story to say real quick. We were in a riot, and it was at this point just only the two of us. We had about 30 Afghan soldiers, and at this point, it's a whole housing unit that was gone nuts. But it's about, 100-some-odd pissed-off detainees and, 33 in a cell that were just, they were actively throwing stuff at us. They're throwing rocks at us. They had broom handles that the Afghan army had given them that they had sharpened to a point, and they were trying to stab us with them. And we were losing control of the situation. I was not confident that once we opened that rec yard door that the Afghan army would be able to hold them back. And so I had looked back, and our command team was behind two layers of fences. And my commander got a Bronze Star, no less. You know, two layers of fences. He was up in the line of danger. But I'm rolling my eyes with sarcasm. But I looked at Maddie and I said, dude, get the fuck out of here. I was like, we're about to go into the rec yard. Get the fuck out of there and go back with the commander. And he looked at me and smiled. And Maddie was, you got to remember, he's 6 foot, big redheaded Bostonian. And he looks at me and he goes, Mac, shove it up your. And I just smiled and I said, well, I'm not responsible for what happens to you at this point. And that took balls. He had more courage than my entire command team did. And he was never recognized for it. You know, my commander got a Bronze Star. If anybody deserved a Bronze Star, it was Maddie. Because he, you know, when I told him to leave, he was, no. And I know a lot of people who would have taken that opportunity, but he told me to go myself because he was not going to leave.
Thank you. Oh, well, I guess we have